Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
So today, this one actually came to us from a colleague, Chaz Wald, the great.
Chazganistan.
Chaz Hands.
Chaz Hands.
Am I editing all this stuff out?
Yeah, you're going to have
to. Okay. And he heard of this alchemist from the early 20th century. And again, that's kind of usually out of our scope, but this guy and his apprentice seem to really, even in the 1920s, to have believed in, or maybe they're really good charlatans or knew how to make their money off of kind of entertainment value, but they seem to have been really secretive and seem to really believe in the art of alchemy. So we'll kind of look at these guys and investigate their lives and kind of figure out why they were so out of place and time. So again, they're in like 1920s, but they really, if you read their works and read about their lives, they really held on to the traditions of the alchemical golden age. So it's kind of like a neo-alchemy from the classical age. So it's ignoring the whole, like everything that came after the 17th and 18th century, basically, and they're steeped in this weird occult system that, you know, is long gone.
So basically a throwback.
Yeah,
like it's, you know, a retrospective of something that's long since gone.
Yeah, so I don't want to, because there's other movements out there that are like, you know, like spiritual alchemy, that's still alive and well in many ways, but these guys were really after the Philosopher's Stone and, you know, holding on to this 17th century like proto-chemistry or kind of pseudoscience. So it's just kind of interesting to read about these guys. It's just, I mean, if you read about them out of context, you might think, okay, yeah, they're, you know, from the 1600s, but they're not.
Well, the first person we're going to look at is Fulcanelli. He was named after a French alchemist and an esoteric author. The name Fulcanelli seems to be a play on words, as it were, because Vulcan, the ancient Roman god of fire, plus El, E-L, that is, a Canaanite named for God, and so therefore the sacred fire. He's generally a mystery to our historical knowledge. His true identity isn't known, but we'll go through some of those theories as we move along in the podcast tonight.
Yeah.
So Travis, what do we know about him that goes beyond his nationality as a Frenchman and the fact that he was highly educated?
Yeah. So, yeah, what we do know is just from his writings and you know, you can get some clues. So he wasn't just like highly educated in general, but he really knew about alchemy and its traditions. So this is why it seems so out of place, because he wrote as if he was a 17th century alchemist. But in his writings, also some other education shows through, namely like that of architecture, art, actual science, and also languages. So, like, the works we have from him are two books that were published after his disappearance, which he kind of disappeared somewhere around 1926. And he had an apprentice or his kind of a student, which was Eugene Cancellier, who we'll get to because more is known about him. One work, or maybe the most famous work, was The Mystery of the Cathedrals.
Which was his magnum opus.
Yeah.
You know, theories about Fulcanelli speculate that he was one or another of a famous French occultist of that time, perhaps a member of the former royal family, the Valois, or another member of the Frères d'Héliopolis, which is the Brotherhood of Heliopolis, a society centered around Fulcanelli, which included Eugene Cancellier, Jean-Julien Champagne, and Jules Brochier.
Yeah, to me the royal family one sounds kind of far-fetched. I don't know. But yeah, there was this brotherhood. So Yeah, it could have been one of those guys, basically. So the those members of the Brotherhood are known, but he's not. So yeah, it could have just been one of those guys.
Now why is that? If he was so important and he was just, you know, a well-connected guy, why are we having trouble with trying to pinpoint who he is?
He did that on purpose. I mean,
this is his
typical
doing.
Alchemist. Yeah,
gotcha.
So we saw this in the past that there might be a publisher, and he's like, it's kind of like Clark Kent and Superman. It's like, yeah, I'm good friends with this alchemist, and I'm publishing his works, but I don't know his true identity because it was him, because it was the publisher.
Now, Travis, would this be because he's trying to protect himself from other people that would go after him because he's dabbling in something he shouldn't be dabbling in, or?
Well, it's the 1920s. He's way out of, Like, if he was an educated man, especially a nobility, and he had a reputation for dabbling in alchemy, I mean.
It's considered low class.
Low class. Think about what would happen if that happened today, because 1920s is basically
no
different
times
than today. Yeah. So let's say you have a
NASA scientist,
upper management guy that, or maybe, you know, maybe, I mean, we're in Europe, could be nobility, whatever. And you know that he has an alchemical lab in his basement, and he's taking it seriously. Like, that's basically the end of his other reputation.
Red flag.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, for pretty obvious reasons. There's more theories. One was by a student of Conseiller's, so a student's student of Fulcanelli named Patrick Riviere. He believed that Fulcanelli's true identity was Jules Voile, who was a famous French physicist. So if he is a famous French physicist, you're going to lose your reputation as a physicist if it's known that you're doing this crazy stuff in your basement, right?
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah. So in 1996, samples of writing by Jean-Julien Champagne, who you just mentioned, who was born in 1877, and Fulcanelli are compared and show considerable similarity, like more than just superficial, you know, just based off of the writing samples, they're saying, okay, it could have been Champagne, and Champagne was a member of this brotherhood. So in any case, there's additionally, there was a guy that we'll get to in a second named Lubitsch, and he did a sketch of Fulcanelli. And there was and if you compare the sketch of Fulcanelli, this is like a really weird story where they kind of met in the shadows, and then later this Lubitsch guy like sketched him off of memory. And if you compare that sketch with images of Champagne, they're identical. Like, it's the same guy. So Lubitsch didn't know what Champagne looked like, but he did the sketch of this guy, and okay. So yeah, there's good chances it was that guy.
So we go a little bit forward here. So during 1925, Fulcanelli relocated to 59 Rue Rochenard, which allegedly was successful in transmuting the base metals into gold at this residence. During 1960, with the publication of the international bestseller, The Morning of the Magicians, Paul Wells and Bergère popularized the mystery of the master alchemist.
Yeah, so with that bestseller, like, he became kind of known, you know, long after his disappearance. So there's another funny or interesting connection here with these guys. Now, again, the Conseiller was Fulcanelli's student. Now, there's some people believe that Conseiller was Fulcanelli. That's
right,
one of the theories.
Right.
But Conseiller himself believed that Fulcanelli's master was Basil Valentine, who we've done a show on, right? So Valentine lived hundreds of years before this, but, you know, with the elixir of life and everything, he could have lived long enough to teach Fulcanelli, according to
a little air of mystery there.
Yeah.
Right.
So Fulcanelli describes in a strange letter that he kind of wore the letter as a talisman, basically. In this letter, he writes that he actually completed the great work by someone that's presumably Basil Valentine. And he also mentions his wife, quote, "When my wife told me the good news, and my wife, with inexplicable intuition of sensitivities, had a really strange dream." So in other words, when he's referring to something as important as the great work, he mentions his wife as someone as important to the Magnus Opus. So there's some connection between his wife and the Philosopher's Stone, or, you know, whatever he was after. So yeah, there's strange theories about who his wife was, or if his wife had a connection. But the trail kind of ends in this. So Powell's, the guy of this 1960s bestseller, according to him, Fulcanelli survived World War II and then disappeared completely after the liberation of Paris. So every attempt to find him failed, and during August 1945, American G2, which is, you know, Army intelligence, asked Bergier to contact a certain army major who was in charge of the operation of searching and discovering German research reports on atomic energy. The anonymous U.S. Army major wanted to know the whereabouts of Fulcanelli, so they heard about this guy. Bergier didn't know anything, and the army major seemed satisfied that Fulcanelli could not be found. No one really heard much about him until 1926, but in 1945, U.S. Army was like, okay, this guy's gone. I mean, it's probably a pseudonym anyways, by 45, they're like, okay, this guy's gone.
All right, so Walter Lang reports that Fulcanelli communicated with Jacques Bergier, who was a chemical engineer and a French resistance member, to warn French atomic physicist André Hollbronner of the man's impending use of nuclear weapons. According to Fulcanelli, nuclear weapons had been used before and by and against humanity. Professor Hollbronner and Chevalier, among others, were assassinated by the Gestapo towards the end of World War II. So maybe there was a little idea that these guys might have some secrets. What are, if they're far-fetched or whatnot, that these guys needed to be eliminated?
Yeah, and it could have been regarding nuclear weapons or some other weapons or who knows what.
Right. The meeting between Jacques Bergier and Fulcanelli occurred during June of 1937 in a laboratory at the Gas Board in Paris. According to Neil Powell, the following is a translation of the original verbatim transcript of the rendezvous. So Fulcanelli told Bergier, and this is from Wikipedia, I'm just going to put that out there, quote, "You're on the brink of success, and indeed are several others of our scientists today. Please allow me, be very, very careful. I warn you, the liberation of nuclear power is easier than you think, and the radioactivity artificially produced can poison the atmosphere of our planet in a very short period of time, a few years. Moreover, atomic explosives can be produced from a few grains of metal powerful enough to destroy whole cities. I'm telling you this for a fact. The alchemists have known this for a very, very long time. I shall not attempt to prove to you what I am now going to say, but I ask you to repeat it to Mr. Hollbronner. Certain geometrical arrangements of highly purified materials are enough to release atomic forces without having recourse to either electricity or vacuum techniques." It continues. "The secret of alchemy is this. There is a way to manipulating matter and energy so as to produce what modern scientists call a field of force. The field acts on the observer and puts him in a privileged position vis-a-vis the universe. From the position, he can access the realities which are ordinarily hidden from us by time and space, matter and energy. This is what we call the great work." Unquote.
Yeah, so here's where the 20th century creeps into his alchemy. So he's talking about nuclear bombs, but he's still saying, okay, so this will put you into hidden knowledge of, the universe, matter, energy, and we call this the great work. So, okay, nuclear fission,
That's sure. A big step in humanity as far as, technological advancement.
I mean, I just think that's a great story. Yeah. So it's just really interesting. So when Bergier asked Fulcanelli about the Philosopher's Stone, the alchemist answers, and this is a quote, "The vital thing is not the transmutation of metals, but that of the experimenter himself. It is an ancient secret that a few people rediscover each century. Unfortunately, only a handful are successful." So is this an influence from the occult revival where he's like saying that the transmutation is within oneself and it's like spiritual alchemy? Hard to say exactly, but obviously this was in the 20th century, so.
Well, listen, we've talked about this ad nauseum. This is a kind of a tip of the hat to the old ways of thinking, from centuries ago about alchemists, isn't it, Travis? You can have all the pieces together to make something, but if you don't believe it or you don't feel the energy to create it yourself from you as a human, you're not going to create the gold. You're not going to create these precious metals.
Yeah, many did believe that, yep. In any case, during December of 1938, the German chemists Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann sent a manuscript to Naturwissenschaften, which is a magazine in Germany at the time, reporting that they had detected the element barium after bombarding uranium with neutrons, which was nuclear fission. Okay,
sure.
So obviously this was theorized before, so it's not like he pulled it out of his hat or was a prophet, but he was proven right a year later in Germany.
Decades before, Marie Curie did the same thing. I mean, well, not the same thing, but she
well, she discovered radioactive decay.
Radioactivity. So, yeah. so that decay knowledge set is already there. So it's not like he's coming.
So they knew about uranium
in the middle of the the 19th century, saying, "Look what I found." There's some building blocks.
So
here.
Yeah, exactly. So right. If he was educated, you know, he would have. You know, if he was educated and had a really a keen interest in the occult, there's no weird things about this story. But so there's another weird story, and that is that according to Consilier, again his student. His last encounter with Fulcanelli happened during 1953, okay? So this is years after his supposed disappearance, when he went to Spain and there was taken to a castle way up in the mountains and, you know, to meet his former master. And Consilier had known Fulcanelli as an old man in his 80s, but now the master had suddenly grown younger and had physically changed in appearance. So he was now kind of, let's say, androgynous.
Hey, that is weird.
And... Fulcanelli called the divine androgyne, and the reunion was really short, and then Fulcanelli once again disappeared this time for good. So this is just a story that Consilier kind of reported, so who knows, but there's another, so to get into Fulcanelli's theories a little further, there's this thing called the phonetic Kabbalah. So it's basically Fulcanelli's term for the special use of language drawing on phonetic similarities and other symbolic techniques for expanding the expressive reach of words. That's kind of a definition from Wikipedia. So basically, it's not like the Hebrew Kabbalah. It's derived from the Latin Kabbalah. In fact, it's really kind of its own thing. So what he means is that it's more like homophonic and symphonic rather than numerical. So it's more based on like phonetic assonance and resonance, and kind of like the echo of the gay science, like Die Fröhliche Wissenschaft by Friedrich Nietzsche, which was published in 1882. So, you know, this is something that was known. Yeah, so it's Kabbalah in the loosest sense, basically. But he had this whole theory around the way words sound and you know, if you can get meaning from similarities and that kind of thing. So we mentioned the mystery of the cathedrals. His other big book was The Dwellings of the Philosophers, which was published in 1929, again, after his 1926 disappearance. And they're both written in this kind of cryptic and erudite manner. It even has like Latin and Greek puns, which is why they think that he was educated in, you know, other languages. And the classic kind of alchemical symbols and symbolism, these double entendres, and it also included lectures on argot and Kant. You know, again, this is kind of to only let in the initiated understand some of the meaning of the book. So if you didn't know Kant very well, you wouldn't get it, for instance. And then there's a third book called The End of the World's Glory, which was kind of a work in progress and never really completed. And the notes for the book were left for a time with Consilier, and Fulcanelli decided that the time for publication was not right, so it was never actually published. Listeners, beware. There's a book published more recently that has the same name, and it's a counterfeit. So if you see that book, I would, you know, take it with a huge grain of salt that it's actually the one that Fulcanelli intended.
Well, you know, Travis, I think, you know, there's a lot of mystery about him, and I think that really draws a lot of people in popular culture to draw upon the mystery of Fulcanelli. The mystery thriller novel, The Alchemist's Secret by Scott Mariani, deals with the subject of the alchemist's disappearance and what may have happened to his manuscript. Fulcanelli is also mentioned in Paulo Coelho's 1993 bestseller, The Alchemist.
A good book.
Yeah, have you read that book?
Yeah.
Okay, it's good. The Hunt for Fulcanelli by Allied and Nazi intelligence services during World War II is a major theme in Martin Langfield's 2009 novel, The Secret Fire.
I want to read that one, because that's like Nazis and allies were looking for him. Like,
well,
why?
You know, the Nazis had issues with the occult, so maybe
allies were, yeah, because he spoke about nuclear bombs or gave a warning. So maybe they're like, okay, what does he know? You know, that's really interesting.
Here's a neat tidbit of information. Here, there's a song entitled "But Who Was Fulcanelli," and that was recorded on the second disc of Frank Zappa's album Guitar.
Yeah.
So that's going to be something. Uh-huh. In the DC Comics universe, Evan Fulcanelli was referred to as the uncle of Xantana, who I believe was a female magician with superpowers. Was that kind of her deal? Relation to Zatara is uncertain.
You don't know that?
I think I know of her from the comics as a kid, but she's kind of one of those outer peripheral sort of DC comic folks. And there's so many more. So I think there's so much natural history built into the Fucinelli story that I think it's very common for authors and musicians to kind of embrace some of that mystery.
One person who actually know a little bit more about his life and might have actually been Fulcanelli was his only real pupil. That's Eugene Consellier. And so he was born in 1899, and he lived until 1982 and lived in France and died in France. And he was a writer and alchemist. They had kind of a close relationship. Like, he wrote all the prefaces for Fulcanelli's books. In 1916, Fulcanelli had accepted Consellier, at least by then. And at that time, Consellier was only 16. And then in 1921, he accepted the sons of Ferdinand de Lesseps as students. And during 1922, two more students, Jules Boucher and Gaston Savange. We mentioned Boucher before. But Consellier was kind of special. He was his best student, and supposedly performed a successful transmutation of 100 grams of lead into gold in this, we mentioned this before, the laboratory of
the gasworks of Sarcelles.
So it's interesting to note that they used something called this projection powder, whatever that is, and it was given to him by Fulcanelli in the presence of Julien Champagne and Gaston Sauvage, who we mentioned.
So he studied at the Lycée Thiers and the Beaux-Arts in Marseille. He reads the great initiates of Charet alchemy and discovers at the age of 13 years reading a copy on a Japan paper of Hermes Unveiled, published for the first time in 1832. Mm-hmm. He became familiar with the occult reading Papas, Stanislas de Wata, Fabre de Ovier.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of kind of interesting stories around this guy and also his student and even the meeting in 1956. So, I mean, he would have been like 113 years old when they met.
Maybe a stretch.
Yeah, so it makes for a really good story. Let me put it that way. It's really interesting to find someone that's, around in the 1920s that's really kind of, first of all, he knows about atomic theory or nuclear fission. And he still insists that he's not only that transmutation of lead into gold is possible, but that he's done it and he has witnesses. So it is really interesting. And then you add Nazis looking for him and the Allied forces looking for him, and it's definitely something that I wanted to look into, and I'll probably pick up even if it's just a novel about him, about the Allies and Nazis looking for him. It's pretty good stuff. So. I hope you enjoyed this one, even though it's not our usual cutoff date from at least before the 19th century.
But strange enough, we have to bring on the show. I think there's a lot of great stuff with this that harkens to the age-old of the mystery of alchemy. So I think it does fit pretty well.
Yeah, this is definitely a fun one to read about and research. So thanks Chaz for bringing this one up to us. And if you do hear about any interesting alchemists, we have lists and lists. But still, if someone says this one's really cool, put this one at the top of your list, then we'll
move
do
up
it.
In the queue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
And we've had a couple of requests like that, and so we'll be doing some of those. But all right, so I hope you like that one, and thank you very much for listening.
Thanks. Take care.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, other episodes, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter @AlchemyPodcast. Tune in to our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.